Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And coming up, the World Bank says the Solomon Islands economy is set fair in the short term, but there may be problems ahead. The Governor of Western Highlands Province urges the PNG government to wake up to a looming El Nino crisis.
It's going to affect the power. It's going to affect all businesses. It's going to affect hospitals. It's going to affect schools. It's going to affect everybody.
And Rafat Leai is the hero as Solomon Islands' central coast topple Vanuatu's Galaxy to reach their first ever OFC Champions League final.
Chelsea Leai! That could be the winner! Sensational from Leai! A hat-trick for him!
So it will be Central Coast versus title holders Auckland City and Bar on Saturday. We'll have more on some dramatic semi-final action later in the programme. I'm Richard Hewitt, and Pacific Beat is produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We start, though, with some grim news from Papua New Guinea, where the results of a survey by the Melanesia Institute point to a disturbing rise in the number of sorcery accusation-related attacks. And the Institute's report says that social media is contributing to the crisis. And while there may be a national action plan in place, as Hilda Wayne reports, the Goroka-based organisation's survey also identified that 9 out of 10 Papua New Guineans believe the government is just not doing enough to curb the rising wave of violence.
When the Melanesian Institute began researching sorcery accusation-related violence in the early 1980s, it was a problem mainly found in PNG's highlands. But over the years, it spread drastically around the country, and the Institute's executive director, Brother Martin Nines, says he's seen an alarming increase.
For instance, in our research, we say that the violence, our people who are living in the villages and the towns and the cities, they say the violence is not an abstract. We see our people in our homes, in our neighbors are being accused or brutally tortured. It is being felt by our people across the country based on this survey.
The Institute surveyed 2,000 participants across every province in PNG. Brother Nina says that these days, more than 70% of people get the information about SAV through social media, which is a huge concern.
And if we continue to post the images of violence through social media, we are in a way promoting and normalizing the violence in our communities, in our families, and in our churches.
It's estimated that on average, more than 6 people are killed each month in PNG because of sorcery accusation-related violence. Melanesian Institute research officer Sister Arnolda Kavanamur says they've seen a change in who the victims are.
In the highlands, women are accused, but now this includes children. You'll see in our last research, men are also accused, so it's changing.
When a person is accused of sorcery, they are often tortured before being killed. And Sister Arnolda says through her work, she's found that violence has gotten worse.
Especially where All men or married, they only got voice in the community. They are vulnerable.
Especially men and women in the community who do not have a voice. They are vulnerable. They don't have anyone to support them. These are usually targeted. Through our research with Melanesia Institute, sometimes they are thrown alive into pit toilets or thrown into rivers. Victims are mainly burnt and tortured.
She says perpetrators may include members of the same family.
So most of these perpetrators they are the close relatives of the survivors. Even husband or even their own children.
Because of this, she says survivors fear retaliation and do not go to court.
And therefore, because all survivors only pray.
And therefore, when the survivors want to take it to court, they fear when they come back, they will be in great trouble. So they say, it's better to let it go. That's why they don't say anything. And most times, they don't report it to police.
In 2015, the PNG government introduced its first national action plan to fight sorcery accusation-related violence. But over the decade it was in place, it was criticized for a lack of funding and concerns few perpetrators went to court. PNG's second national action plan was presented last year, but Brother Martin Nine says he's yet to see a published version.
So we call on our government to publish these important documents and fund it so we could carry on the work at the grassroots level and also make it available in our school institutions, also in our churches, because this is a very important document for our country and also for our people.
He says police, church and community leaders are the first responders of violence at the community level, but they are not adequately supported.
And how can we support them also? With logistic supports, because most of the time, the police and our communities, they have all the will to reach out to more communities, but they cannot do more when there is limited fundings.
More than 90% of people surveyed by the Institute believe the government isn't doing enough to prevent sorcery accusation-related violence. And Brother Nines is calling on the PNG government to implement and fund the National Action Plan immediately.
So our people, they can also implement this program in their communities. Because at the moment, they haven't released this document.
Brother Martin Nines, Executive Director of the Melanesian Institute, ending that report from Hilda Wayne. Personally, I've lost count of the number of stories that we've done on this program about sorcery accusation-related attacks, and still it goes on, and now we're being told it's getting worse. How many years is it since one case in Mount Hagen made international headlines, and yet PNG government after government seems to have no idea how to deal with such a terrible problem? Pacific Pete has asked for comment from the Minister for Justice and the Secretary of the National Action Plan, but we are yet to receive a response.
Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that takes us on to a story about the Solomon Islands, because the economy is on the rise there, with the World Bank projecting 2.8% growth for this year. It's a significant rebound from the days of the COVID-19 pandemic, when the economy shrank for three consecutive years. However, the World Bank projection comes with a warning that future growth will be focused solely on the mining sector, remittances and infrastructure development. Bernard Harbone is the bank's resident representative for Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, and he says with 9,000 youths entering the market every year and only 2,000 places available, more jobs are needed urgently.
At the moment this year, mining will represent 53% of exports. So on one hand, that's a great windfall, but on the other hand, there are huge challenges there. And those challenges, we don't even need to do a massive amount of scrutiny on what's happening today. You just look historically both at logging and mining in the past. The environmental and social impacts and the way in which revenues from the extraordinary resource of the country's forests have not necessarily come into the state coffers. So the key question, whilst pushing the mining sector, which is very capital intensive and not labor intensive, is to push that sector to be more environmentally and socially conscious, but at the same time to work with the government, and it's expressed its real commitment to lock down the mining sector, is that those revenues go into the treasury and then use those revenues, that windfall, in order to diversify the economy into other sectors such as agriculture, tourism, fisheries, and so on. That's where the jobs are going to be created, not the mining sector. The mining sector is, if you will, the golden goose, and the question is how it can be treated well and to learn from the past in order to benefit the future.
Bernard, in terms of jobs, are there jobs within the mining sector similar to how it was with logging, or is this area not as labor intensive? Will that create a problem with all these? We're talking about 9,000 people entering the job market every year. Where would they end up going?
Mining requires heavy machinery rather than lots of people. And a certain cohort needs to be skilled. And so whilst we all really support the sentiment of local content and local employment in the sector, at the moment, a certain cohort is coming from the outside, from the Philippines, from Malaysia, and so on and so forth. And so the question is how you can upskill Solomon Islanders so they can take those better, more skilled jobs, bearing in mind that it's not a huge employer. So the key challenge and the key task of the government is to harness the resources from gold, bauxite, copper revenues, and to use that revenue to then spend better and to support the sectors, the other sectors, which are going to be bigger employment opportunities for that young population. What we're really advocating for is to allow more space for the private sector, because that's absolutely key, both in terms of the domestic private sector, but also to allow for more cross-border investments.
I wanted to ask about remittances. So there's thousands of Solomon Islanders who are at work in Australia, New Zealand, and we've seen money coming back into the country. What did the report say about remittances, and is this a sustainable way of development?
Well, remittances will soon be the second largest portion of foreign exchange for the country in terms of remittances back into the country from seasonal labor. And it represents a lifeline, it represents a big opportunity. But what we see is, and it's still a little bit anecdotal, we need to dig into those figures, is that, for example, graduates are lining up to go for these opportunities abroad. And that's not really what you want. You don't want your graduate cohort going into lower skills into agriculture or lower skills in services. And so what you want is you want a more dynamic economy that's offering more highly educated, more highly skilled young to go into jobs here in the country. So I know there is a tension across the Pacific about the role of seasonal labor. I think at the moment it does provide a lifeline both at the micro level for individuals and at the macro level in terms of remittances. But you want to see a transition over time where you have a healthy economy at home providing those opportunities for young people.
Now, looking at the Wale government and the path forward, there's a couple of bills before Parliament. There's the Mineral Resources Bill. There's the VAT Bill. How important are these bills towards ensuring that Solomon Islands can diversify its economy and that growth is sustainable?
Both the government and its development partners see those two key pieces of legislation as really important. The VAT bill in terms of cleaning up and gradually increasing domestic revenues. And then secondly, the Mineral Resources Bill being passed to provide confidence to particularly external investors about a solid platform in which to start investing in the mining sector and to encourage more blue ribbon legitimate investors to come into the sector rather than what's seen as this kind of transition from logging companies then turning into mining companies with perhaps not the best kind of record.
Bernard Harbon there, the World Bank's resident representative for Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. He was speaking to Pacific Beat's Evan Wasuka. Well, Prime Minister Matthew Wale has told delegates at the inaugural PNG Solomon Islands Business Investment Forum in Honiara that one source of growth for the Solomons could come through strengthened trade relations with their Melanesian neighbours. Mr. Wale pointed to more than 50 Papua New Guinean companies operating in his country across many sectors at an estimated value of around 1 billion kina. That's around 315 million Australian dollars. Mr. Wale said these investments have generated employment, deepened competition and improved services for his people.
We want PNG companies to build partnerships with Solomon Islands businesses, not simply operate alongside them.
joint ventures, local supply contracts, technical training, and pathways to local ownership should become normal features of investments. Inclusive growth is not only socially responsible, it is smart economics. Economies where more people participate are stronger, more resilient, and more sustainable.
Solomon Islands Prime Minister Matthew Wiley at the inaugural PNG Solomon Islands Business Investment Forum in Honiara.
Join Natasha Metten for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
Cut to me landing in Tonga and showing up on my auntie's doorstep, and they had no idea I was coming. It was late at night and they had no idea who I was. I felt the full weight of my adoption at that time.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't worry, I'm pretty sure there are rules that will prevent Michael from entering, but he can go away and practice if he wishes. You're with Pacific Beats here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt, sitting in for Agi Tupou on this occasion. And the governor of Western Highlands Province in Papua New Guinea, Wairarapa, is sounding the alarm of what he believes could be a life-threatening El Nino crisis. He says his province doesn't have the money or the necessary resources to respond if the drought continues, with rivers running dry and food supplies already under threat. Governor Rapa says the national government needs to wake up to the crisis and act now by providing clear direction and urgent support.
I've never seen this kind of dry season. My province in Western Islands province is a food basket of the whole country. The creeks are drying up, rivers are drying up, and then it looks like it's going to cause some health issue too. Looks like the hospitals will be affected, schools will be affected, public servants will be affected. And like my province now, we haven't got the budget to really put up with all this. And we do not have any clear direction coming from the government talking about this El Nino.
The El Nino was declared back in June. Do you think the PNG government since then should have been doing more to help prepare provinces like yours for the months ahead?
Yeah. Well, from the provinces, we have disaster offices that they coordinate with our national disaster office. But as of today, we are not getting any clear direction coming from the national disaster office. Too, there's few, I think, advice and things coming from the government that we provinces and the members of parliament, we have to look into it too. But we don't have the resource to put up with the kind of frightening and you know that is coming up. From Western Highlands province, we only depend on the government grant, the small grant that they give us, and then also with a little bit of GST that we receive from our business houses. That's all. We operate on that all.
Do you think they've made it enough of a priority?
It's a life-threatening kind of El Nino coming up. It should be the top priority now. Our government now is, we are planning into going into the election 2027 and all that. But before that, I think our important thing now is we should talk about the El Nino thing then, rather than talking about the election or any other things. The government should, you know, send out clear message that we're having a situation like that coming up. We have to stop any other things happening and we need to prepare for this to the worst. And I think the scientists have told us already that, you know, we are going to have a super El Nino. I think the message, we got it already. But our responsible authorities are not, you know, always telling the people wrong. So maybe the government might not feel good the way I put the news, but at least someone has to say it. The weather is not someone's fault. So it's the effect of the climate change, maybe in the whole world, and we're coming to this situation, so I don't blame anybody, but it's just a wake-up call that we all have to prepare for this.
PNG has also secured 300 million kina from the World Bank, specifically to assist with El Nino. Are you hoping that this will be fast-tracked so it gets to the provinces quickly?
Yes, I'm aware of that. Our government is negotiating that loan from the World Bank, that how soon and how fast this is going to come. Are we going to receive all that money in full, or there's some other requirements need to be put in place? I mean, all these things. But if our government can be able to secure that money, then that's fine.
And what are your biggest fears for your own province, I guess, if more assistance doesn't come quickly?
People will go angry. It will be related to all kinds of problems. A water that used to give us water supply, I went there yesterday and seeing that river is drying up to the Kum River. The electricity we're getting it from the river, you see, like the Ramu power. Ramu, because it's a river that is generating power. It's going to affect the power. It's going to affect all businesses. It's going to affect hospitals. It's going to affect schools. It's going to affect everybody.
Western Highlands Governor Wairarapa making it clear how he feels about a looming El Nino crisis and urging the Papua New Government to act now before, I guess, it could be too late. And Wairarapa was speaking there to Pacific Beat's Natasha Emick. And we take a look at some of the other stories making headlines around the Pacific on this, Thursday morning, I think it is?
I think so, to say.
Yeah, that'll do. Wednesday if you're on the other side of the dateline, of course. And another weather story to start with. Northern Marianas must be wondering what they've done. A tropical storm has formed northeast of Chuuk and seems to be heading towards the Northern Marianas. Grim news.
Yes, yeah, just after the last one. But this tropical storm named Sordel is tracking north-northeastward, according to the Joint Typhoon Warning Centre. Now, the JTWC said that there's been a stall in the storm's development and it has weakened a little bit, but warned that the current environment is favourable for further development.
So that said, what can we expect in the coming days from Sordel?
Well, the forecast for Sordel is that it's going to rapidly intensify as the system takes advantage of the warm sea surface temperatures, which is characteristic of an El Nino. Now, if you ask what the Northern Marianas has done, unfortunately, it's just exist on that belt where the El Nino and the warm waters do create more frequent cyclones in the case of an El Nino. Now, the United States National Weather Service predict that Sordel will reach the north of the Northern Marianas by Saturday, and that by then it will strengthen into a Category 3 or 4 typhoon, which means that winds could range from 178 to 251 kilometres an hour.
Fingers crossed that things don't turn out quite like that. Now, next to Vanuatu and the minimum age for those who want to participate in overseas seasonal labour schemes like the PALM scheme here in Australia might be raised to 25.
Yeah, so the Commissioner of Labour, James Willey, said that Vanuatu is considering raising the minimum age for workers entering Australia and New Zealand's seasonal labour mobility programs from 21 to 25. Now, according to the Daily Post, he said that bringing up the minimum age would give young people more time to remain in education as well as training before seeking overseas employment. Now, this all comes after a number of reports that we've looked at here on Pacific Beat of workers absconding from work, as well as mistreatment and exploitation by employees. Now, this proposed change would apply to workers entering things like the Australian PALM scheme, as well as the recognised seasonal employer scheme and the seasonal worker program arrangements.
And to Fiji, the Prime Minister, Sitiveliamangaboa Booker, putting his faith in the legal system there. He didn't like the decision that the High Court handed down over the quashing of a Commission of Inquiry report. He says if his appeal, and I think he's thinking that there could be at least two, but if one or the other isn't successful, he's going to resign, right?
Yeah, so we spoke about this a couple of days ago, but the Fijian Prime Minister, Sitiveliamangaboa, says that he will appeal against the High Court decision to void the Commissioner of Inquiry report into the appointment of a former head of the country's anti-corruption agency. Now, we did speak about that a few days ago. He is planning to appeal the parts of the judgment that just relate to him and his behaviour. But more than that, he's also responded to questions about the outcome of the appeal. So when asked if he would resign if his appeal to the High Court fail, he replied, correct. So there's the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, and then that is the end of the line.
Fair way to go, I would suggest, before we know one way or the other. But certainly Sitiveliamangaboa Booker clearly must be confident that he will get the result he's looking for eventually. Diana, thanks very much indeed for the update. Going to move on to soccer in particular now as we switch to a sporting theme, and it will be Solomon Islands versus New Zealand. in the OFC Champions League final in Fiji on Saturday. This after Central Coast and title holders Auckland City won their respective semi-finals. Auckland cruised through against host club Rewa FC, but Central Coast were involved in a mighty tussle with Vanuatu's Galaxy FC. The Solomons team taking control in the first half, but they hardly had a kick after the break as Galaxy fought back to take the match to extra time with the score at 2-2. Again, they dominated and star striker Medina could easily have had his fourth hat-trick in a row, but he was upstaged in the end by Central Coast hero Rafa Leai, who scored the winner with just seconds to go.
Over the top again, an opportunity here, off the post, a chance again for Central Coast, Leai strikes early for Central Coast FC, they're in the lead, 1-0, links up with Leslie, through it goes for Limoki, a chance here, Leai, and it goes, a double for Leai. And a place in the finals looks bright for Central Coast FC at the moment. Falls for Medina. Medina strikes it. Medina with the reply. Could this be the comeback for Galaxy FC? It's 2-1. Through it goes Medina. Wonderful work from Medina. A double for him in this semi-final and they are back. Courtney Jr. rolls it down for Leai. A chance here, Leai! That could be the winner! Sensational from Leai. A hat-trick for him. And he could possibly have sealed the deal here in Bar. That's it! Central Coast FC can celebrate here in Bar. Leai has played an absolute blinder for the Solomon Island Club.
Me bara happy too much. Me fa go through for grand final. Only thing lo mine, shoot on target. Yeah, because our previous games, me no convert good. Now me have to do him serious. So me put him inside lo net.
Buttram, hard luck, but you were 2-0 down. The boys really came through in the second spell, but it just didn't work for you.
Yeah, we knew that we will come back again in the second half. And the credit to the boys, they did very well from 2-0 down and then come back 2-0. We never give up, and the boys got the courage and fight back. When you play against especially the best striker like Central Coast, they got single mistake from centre-back, so clear their way with the head. That's football.
Congratulations, Jacob Morley. You've guided Central Coast FC into their first final in the OFC Men's Champions League.
As you say, it's history in our very short existence. So the boys are very happy about the win and looking forward for the final.
What can you say about Rafa Leai?
Well, today he stood up, so that's the good thing. He scored 3 goals, so I'm very happy for him.
How do you see the final against Auckland City FC?
Well, Auckland is a good side. They've got quality players all over the park, so we just have to be on our game and we have to go back and work on something that we think can help us to play against Auckland.
Central Coast coach Jacob Morley talking there to Satish Narain and Auckland City. Well, they're on track now for a fifth title in a row, 13th overall, should they make it. This after they defeated Rewa FC by 3-1 in the first semi-final. The New Zealanders looked a different team to the one that struggled at times during the group stage. While Rewa rarely threatened, and when they did score, it was in the dying moments of the match. We'll hear from Auckland City's head coach, Rudolf Moser, in a moment, but first, the highlights.
Lovely touch, De Vries tried to get the head, and Dondera getting away in the front, and Auckland City FC draw first blood in the semi-final. Goal for Jared Garriga. Dondera swings it in, it's in there, and well, tipped in. Rostron is the man who's celebrating, and Nathan Rostron makes it 2-0. Too much pressure on the defense, and the set-piece play with the corner works for Auckland City FC. Now coming away is Matt Ellis. Matt Ellis, he scores. Auckland City FC go up 3-0. Warren Ivalu tries to send it through. Oh, that's one in. It's a little too late, but Josiah Sella, Paul Swan back.
They tried to play as well, but I think from first minute we were very dominant and definitely deserved the win. I think the score, with all respect to Riva, this game could have been a lot more goal difference. I think even the goal we conceded kind of upsets me a little bit, but if you look 30 seconds early, we hit a crossbar, and then from that counter they scored. So that's probably the only disappointing part, but I think we kept them relatively quiet, and I think the team effort was fantastic, and I hope that gives us a good setup for the final, which is big.
Certainly is. Auckland City coach Rudolf Moser and the OFC Champions League final. Auckland City versus Central Coast kicks off at 3 p.m. local time in Bar on Saturday. And if you'd find yourself at a loose end, check out that Galaxy Central Coast game. It was an absolute cracker and a brilliant advert for soccer in the Pacific. We stay on that subject because barely 6 months after he took office, the president of Lay Football Association, Ronald Ram, has big plans to re-establish Papua New Guinea's second city as the country's soccer capital. Crucially, after years of infighting, Mr. Ram has the PNG FA on his side and a sizeable FIFA loan is in the works. And that money would be spent on upgrading stadium facilities and creating a new high-performance centre. Since he became Lay FA president in January, Ronald Ram has been on a charm offensive, and it's worked. Not only is PNG FA president John Caponato on board, so is the chair of Lay City Authority, Deputy Prime Minister John Rosso. Mr. Ram says there is no shortage of clubs or talent in and around Lay, but for far too long, they've been lagging behind on infrastructure.
Lay has always been the capital of soccer in PNG, and Lay Football Association is one of the largest football associations in Papua New Guinea. We've got, if I'm not wrong, 44 registered clubs with us, men's and women's. We've got under 18 teams, and then we're running school soccer as well. So we have been talking to PNG FA, we have been talking to Lay City Authority. They're all trying to get into this and build something proper for Lay.
The hope is that work will start in September, and by the end of 2028, Lay Football Association will have a total new look. The programme includes ground improvements and a mini stadium with a new high-performance centre. Ronald Ram says the old one has been neglected because it was just too far away.
Yep, too remote, and the last 21 years, there has not been even a single upgrade done to that place. So financially, PNGFA has verbally told me there will be FIFA funds for Play Football Association. We have gathered basically all the documents and everything they needed. It will be submitted to PNGFA, and they will apply for, I think it's a 500,000 loan towards Play Football Association.
So Lay City chancing their arm here, trying to bring it around. This is good play. Lay City with an opportunity. Plenty of bodies in there. And here comes the shot. Fantastic for Lay City FC.
Lay City FC didn't quite make it to the OFC Champions League semi-finals, but they've done a good job of flying the flag under coach and former PNG international Valentine Nelson.
Unfortunately for us, not the result that we wanted, but we are pleased with their performance. It's something that we can learn from and build our team in the future, especially those new ones coming up. They've shown maturity in their games, and I'm so impressed with their performance. With this tournament, they have showcased that they have matured enough to compete at that level. I believe if we happen to get the championship for the domestic league, we'll definitely come back stronger and better next time.
80-90% of the team, they're all young boys, under 16s, under 19s, very raw talent. Those boys are all from Lay Football Association, from the minor clubs, all selected. We have immense talent, but we haven't managed them properly. And we would love to give something to these young talents. So I think this will be huge for Lay.
Why something like this didn't happen sooner would appear to be entirely down to the bad blood with the PNG FA. Lay was left out in the cold when it came to member association grants, never mind something as big as the project they're about to embark upon.
I agree with you. Finally, they are coming on board. They had some issues with the previous management. I'm not sure, but I've heard that that was the whole reason that PNGFA did not want to release the funds, because they were thinking that might not be utilized properly. I would agree the relationship between Lay Football Association and PNGFA wasn't so great in the past, and we hardly get MA grants in the last couple of years. And now we are looking forward to start this major project, which is very important. You know, I mean, 20 years, Lay Football Association, biggest association in Papua New Guinea, and we are basically playing on mud and stones at the moment.
But not for much longer, if all goes to plan, and the hope is that eventually Lay FA will field a team of their own in the OFC Pro League.
We want to be professional. We are right into grassroots. We'll be doing school soccer big way, youth development, women's soccer, our LFA squad already done, under 21s, under 18s, under 16s. We'd love to see our women PNG National Soccer League next year, LFA squad. And then 2028, I would like to see our men's team in Premier League Soccer. There will be LFA squad. We just want to take one step at a time and do it properly. So OFC Pro League is on the cards.
Ronald Ram, president of Lay Football Association, and very clearly hoping to take soccer in and around PNG's second city to a whole new level over the next couple of years.
Yo, Michael Chow, what's with the guitar, bro?
Jake McQuire, haven't you heard? Entries for Pacific Break open this month.
Brother, you know this competition is for up-and-coming artists from the Pacific and Timor-Leste, right?
Just imagine it. Joining the Pacific Break Winners Hall of Fame alongside Sprigga Mech, Danielle, Juben, Chris Rojemai, Mantis, and now Michael Chow. Okay, I better go book some studio time.
Entries open Wednesday, the 26th of August, so get your original tracks together and head to abc.net.au/Pacific Break to find out more.
Here in the Pacific, disasters are inevitable. Floods, cyclones, tsunamis, fires, earthquakes. Whatever the disaster, if it strikes your home, there is a way you can be prepared. A go bag. A bag of essential items that could save your life in a disaster. You should pack your go bag now so that if there is a disaster, you can pick it up and go. The things you should put in it are water, food, medicine, toiletries, hand sanitizer, and a first aid kit. You should also pack a radio, blankets, protective clothing, garbage bags, a light, small tools like a knife, a can opener, and a whistle to alert emergency services. Oh, and don't forget copies of important documents. Disasters may be inevitable, but the loss of your life or your family are not. Prepare your go bag now and stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the National Referral Hospital in Honiara is in danger of running out of blood for critically ill patients. And now managers are working with Solomon Islands Red Cross to encourage more members of the public to come forward and donate. It's not the first time the hospital has run into trouble as it continues to rely on companies and organisations like the University of the South Pacific and its students to top up blood stocks. Red Cross volunteer James Salip says persuading more people to donate is a real challenge because there are no payments to be had.
At the moment, our programmes were not under any funding, so we are... This financial constraint is always what hinders programs, like from the logistic to the donor refreshments and all the stuff here. We only have one or two companies, actually, who always support in terms of refreshments, but that is just based on their goodwill. So whatever support that they provide, that is what we can give to the donors.
When you say refreshments, what are these refreshments?
When I'm talking about refreshment, it's for the post-donor care. Like, we give them something like corned beef. We give them something to, like, the drinks or that the donors need to, you know, to replenish their energy after donating blood.
Last week, there was a drive for students to donate blood. How did they go?
Like, that was last week at a three-day blood drives organized by the USPSI campus. We started the program on Wednesday till to Friday last week because they hosted the open day. So they invited us if we can go there to, you know, collect blood from the students or maybe the public if they attended the program. So it was successful. We collected a number of blood donors during the program, and was a good turnout for students as well. Most young people, they turn out for the awareness programs and the blood donation. We receive a number of blood donors, which I think would help a bit with the supply at our National Referral Hospital at the moment.
Are people generally willing to donate blood, or sometimes it's a bit hard due to maybe cultural constraints or things like that?
For us here, the donor turnout is always a challenge because people have doubts and fears and maybe cultural constraints like you just said. Yeah, so we try as much as we can to overcome those challenges in order that we can, you know, educate more of our people so that the public can become aware of what actually is this program. And one of the things that I've seen throughout my term here as well too is that people were expecting something in return which is also against the policy of volunteer blood donation, because we have the policy that we cannot buy blood, or when you donated blood, you give it from your heart, and it's not something that you're expecting to gain something out of it. So I think that's one of the factors that is also hindering people from coming out in great numbers, and like other Pacific countries, if I could say it here. And one of the things that I've seen throughout my term here as well too is that people were expecting something in return, which is also against the policy of volunteer blood donation, because we have the policy that we cannot buy blood. When you donated blood, you give it from your heart, and it's not something that you're expecting to gain something out of it. So I think that's one of the factors that is also hindering people from coming out in great numbers in like other Pacific countries, if I could say it here.
Do you use the media in your campaigns?
The approaches that we are using is that we use the media as well, face-to-face awareness outreach program. We do on radio, on air as well.
What about social media?
Social media, yeah. The situation is not the current situation. It's an ongoing situation that here in the Solomon Islands, especially our National River Hospital, we experience the shortages of blood. Yeah, so as I've said, our supply versus the demand is a challenge. We have a demand of almost three times the supply. So that posed a challenge to us, but we are working tirelessly to get people to become aware of the importance of this program, that this program is not only just giving blood, but it's a community service. It is a shared responsibility that I think every citizen and everyone to save one another and then to save lives. Yeah.
If people were listening to our conversation in Solomon Islands, what would you like to say to them?
I think to my people of Solomon Islands, I think this voluntary non-remunerated blood program, it's a voluntary blood program that I think and I wish to share with the community and the Solomon Islands, that this is not just an act of giving blood. Yeah, when you give blood to somebody, you give them second chance. Our mothers, our aunties, maybe our fathers, our children who are, you know, very ill and suffered at the hospital, they need your hand. They need your help. So I think we should treat this program as a shared responsibility that each and every citizen in this country, I think we should take the responsibility to give blood and to save lives. When you turn out to give blood, you give a second chance to somebody. Somebody you don't know. It may be your aunt, it may be our next leader, or maybe our community leader. Who knows? So the act of saving lives, I think it should be something that should be in our hearts, be like Christ, yeah, to save life.
So the call is out. Let's hope the people of Solomon Islands, and particularly in and around Honiara, heed the call. James Sully, a volunteer with Solomon Islands Red Cross, he was speaking to Caroline Tierman. That's just about it from this edition of Pacific Beat. Tomorrow morning's program will be coming out of our studios in Nuku'alofa. And your host will be Marian Kupu, so no doubt with a focus on what's been happening in Tonga in recent days, as well as other news from across and around the Pacific. I'm Richard Hewitt, sitting in for Aggie Tupou on this occasion. Aggie returns, I believe, on Monday morning, and I'll be back during next week. Well, actually, I won't. I'm on a few days' leave, maybe the week after with the afternoon show. So I'll enjoy my break. If you're having yours, I hope you enjoy one too. If you're going to work, well, do the best you can. Have a good day.